Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did taking medication for everyday mental health complaints become part of the American way of life? Until the 1950s, the treatment of choice for anxiety was Freudian analysis, but therapy required a serious time commitment and significant financial means. So the newly invented tranquilizer Milltown took the nation by storm in 1955, earning rousing endorsements from actors and socialites who made the drug so fashionable some people took it with little more thought than they would give to an aspirin for a headache. So how did that era lead us to where we are today? Andrea Tone is here to talk about that. She is Canada Research Chair in the Social History of Medicine at McGill University. Her new book is called The Age of Anxiety, A History of America's Turbulent Affair with Tranquilizers. Andrea, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
What made life particularly stressful in 1950s America?
I don't think you can say that life in 1950s America was any more stressful than it is today, although people have tried to compare stress levels over time. But anxiety is something that's evolved, and how it's been understood and interpreted and treated has changed with the times. But I think what helped make Milltown so successful, as you described, was a convergence of different events and different ideas and personalities. One was the fact that it was the Cold War, and that when Milltown arrived on the market in 1955, Americans were immersed in a culture that really emphasized the importance of atomic anxiety and thinking of ways to manage and control it. Another thing that was happening in the 1950s that encouraged people to take a drug to manage their everyday stress was the rise of a convenience mentality. So even as McDonald's hamburgers were taking off, credit cards, consumer items such as refrigerators, along comes a pill, which people saw as just another consumer commodity that they could take with impunity and that they should take to help deal with these larger issues at bay.
Was anxiety commonly understood to be a medical condition in the early part of the 20th century, or was it just something people were expected to live with?
Yeah, it's a really good question. If one were to talk to a Freudian analyst in the 1950s, then neurosis was real, and it was something that should be treated on a psychiatrist's couch. But it was something that one should not take a pharmaceutical treatment for. And yet at the same time, in the 1950s, you had a long-standing history in the United States of people taking all sorts of drugs, including alcohol, to manage anxiety. So officially, in medical discourse, neurosis was real. It wasn't to be confused with serious psychiatric disorders that required institutionalization. But most Americans actually eschewed the therapist's couch for financial reasons, because they didn't have the time to commit to it, because there were a lot of indignities that came in the 1950s to admitting to seeing a shrink in favor of over-the-counter remedies. And so along comes Milltown in 1955, and it's doctor-sanctioned. It's something you could get not from a psychiatrist, but from your everyday internist or family practitioner, and it was not seen as a serious psychiatric drug for a serious psychiatric problem. It was called in the press emotional aspirin, or in keeping with that Cold War theme, a peace pill, just something to kind of help you get through the day.
Yeah, so in other words, people didn't worry that they would be viewed as having something wrong with them if they used this medication and admitted to using it.
No, I mean, the really interesting thing about stress in the popular press in the 1950s is that people almost characterized it as a badge of achievement. So for listeners who've watched the very popular TV series Mad Men, you see how businessmen, after the end of a hard day, will retire over martinis. A martini is another anxiolytic, and it's something that people didn't stigmatize as a drug that was going to help these men unwind, and therefore they're, you know, stigmatized as having a disorder. Stress, everyday anxiety, was seen as something almost to be proud of, and people boasted of the fact that they had some kind of anxiety, that they took tranquilizers. Anxiety in the 1950s and tranquilizer use was almost a quasi-public experience.
So Miltown is the first blockbuster tranquilizer, but it's really amazing, given the way the world is today, to think that the drug company did not realize at first what a gold mine it had developed and, in fact, sort of held back.
Yeah, it's a fantastic story. The person who invented Miltown, Frank Berger, who passed away a couple of months ago, was looking at a preservative for penicillin, which was a big issue in World War II when they couldn't manufacture enough penicillin to help the civilian and military population. And he came across a drug that didn't work so well as a penicillin preservative, but did work quite effectively as a tranquilizer and muscle relaxant. And he was hired in 1949 by Carter Wallace, which at the time was best known for its Carter's Little Liver Pills, which were an over-the-counter laxative. And he decided to take this drug that he had previously worked with and fine-tune it. And he synthesized the drug that would become Miltown in 1950. He was very excited because he tested it on mice and guinea pigs. And what was remarkable is that these rodents were conscious, but they were clearly very calm. So unlike rodents given barbiturates who sort of pass out in this oblivious state, this was a drug that clearly minimized anxiety but kept people awake. So he presents his findings to the head of the company, Henry Hoyt, and says, look, we have in our hands, you know, a drug that could be a tranquilizer. And the president said, yeah, that's nice, but I don't think there will be a market for this because this is, you know, the heyday of Freudian analysis within the medical community. And Hoyt commissioned a poll and asked 200 doctors whether they would be willing to prescribe a tranquilizer for everyday anxiety. And a majority of them said no. So the company actually held back what would later become the fastest-selling drug in American history and the first psychotropic blockbuster in American history. It took 5 years before the drug made it onto the market.
Let's stop here and get a little bit of technical information. You mentioned barbiturates, and there is a difference in between major tranquilizers and minor tranquilizers. Can you clarify that a little bit for us?
Yes, major tranquilizers, which became popular in the United States in 1954, so a year before Miltown came on the market, were drugs that were used to treat psychosis, schizophrenia. So the one that was first successful was the drug Thorazine. These are drugs that in the 1950s were usually used on people who were institutionalized. Minor tranquilizers refer to first Miltown, later Librium and Valium, that were targeted for patients who had everyday trouble, stress, anxiety, however you wanted to code it. But these were people who were largely in the outpatient population. So major tranquilizers are the phenothiazines, and minor tranquilizers refer to drugs such as Miltown and Valium.
How long did it take before doctors began to understand that these drugs could be abused and were, in fact, addictive?
It took a while. The very first studies that were done on the habit-forming potential of benzodiazepines and Miltown were done in the late 1950s and early 1960s. So we could say on the one hand that a small group of doctors who were reading pretty specialized journals were made aware, if they read these, that these drugs could be habit-forming. The problem at this time, and we have to remember that in today's age, it's really easy to hop onto Google and the Internet or to look at any variety of books that are published on the side effects of prescription drugs. Back in the 1950s, ordinary consumers and even doctors didn't have access to that wealth of information. So doctors had to get their information from whatever studies that were published in medical journals, and really the science of addiction was in its infancy at this time. What they mainly relied on was something called the physician's desk reference, which we still have today, but the information that was published in the PDR was supplied by manufacturers. So if you or I, hypothetically, wanted to get a tranquilizer in the 1950s and, you know, thousands of patients demanded Miltown by name from their doctors, the doctor wouldn't necessarily have a lot of information on the hazards of that drug, and you or I would be dependent largely on the doctor to tell us what those hazards were. So there was a long stretch of time in the story of the development of tranquilizer use when people, doctors included, were really in the dark, but especially consumers were just not aware of the addictive qualities of tranquilizers.
And these were things that were also made really popular by the fact that actors and athletes and well-known business people, even presidents, were taking them without much thought to the consequence or to the effect other than the fact that they felt better.
Right. I mean, one of the really fascinating things I found working on this book is just how popular the drug was first in Hollywood and also among men. So when we talk about tranquilizers today, we usually think of mother's little helpers, and these are drugs that are, you know, salves for harried housewives. But back in the 1950s, these drugs were widely used by businessmen. In fact, they were so commonly used by businessmen that they had the nickname of executive Excedrin. But they were also used by athletes. They were used by actors, and other entertainers, playwrights, journalists, frantic to make deadlines. And in the community of Hollywood and greater L.A., they were really very hip and fashionable. And one of the results of this is that the celebrity culture and the literati of the day, in an era when drugs hadn't been stigmatized like they are today, at a time when being anxious could be viewed as an emblem of struggle but also of success, people talked very, very openly about their tranquilizer use. And the person who really stands out here is the TV superstar Milton Berle, who was really America's first great TV superstar, so popular on Tuesday nights that a lot of restaurants and PTA meetings just had to shut down because everyone was glued to their television sets watching this guy. And he talked about how anxious he was being on television, but how Milltown really helped take the edge off. And so at one point he said, you know, it's so great, I'm thinking of changing my name to Milltown Berle, which, you know, was really quite fascinating. So today we live in a time of direct-to-consumer advertising where companies pay celebrities huge amounts of money to endorse specific drugs. Back then, that was banned. And the FDA was so alarmed that the company was paying all these celebrities, so not just Berle, but also Tallulah Bankhead and Tennessee Williams and Norman Mailer, to endorse these products, that they launched a secret investigation to see if, in fact, there was a trail of money that could be tracked between the company and these individual celebrities. And they found, much to their disappointment, that there was no hint of impropriety. It's just that these people were smitten with their tranquilizers.
They really did love these drugs.
They love these drugs.
Well, you know, it's funny because even today it seems to be a sign of how important one is to have to multitask and to be stressed out. That part of the culture really hasn't changed very much.
That's true. That's true. And in fact, psychiatrists who prescribed these drugs and were enthusiastic about them in the 1950s said, you know, what's not to like about these drugs? We live in a very stressed society. It's the Cold War. We're racing to get ahead of the Soviets. And if these drugs promote functionality and efficiency, if they coax the unemployed back into the workplace, if they smooth over cultural fissures within families, this is a good drug.
Andrea Tone is my guest. Her new book is called The Age of Anxiety, A History of America's Turbulent Affair with Tranquilizers. We will hear more after the break, and you're welcome to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses beginning in January. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. I'm speaking this hour with Andrea Tone. She's Canada Research Chair in the Social History of Medicine at McGill University. Her new book is called The Age of Anxiety, A History of America's Turbulent Affair with Tranquilizers. You can join us by sending an email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Andrea, we talked a little bit about the mother's little helper phenomenon. Would you talk, though, for a minute about how the feminist movement used the Milltown phenomenon to sort of prove its case that women were being subjugated?
Yeah, it came about a bit later. What happened is that in the late 1960s, the first utilization studies were done, which were studies breaking down the population and determining who actually took tranquilizers. So this was the first time, 1968, that people became aware that roughly two-thirds of all people who took tranquilizers were women, and that a majority of these women were suburban housewives. There was a huge outcry and outroar about this in the media, you know, that the safe, sanctimonious home had been chemically contaminated. And it, over time, generated a lot of criticism about how these drugs had come to move from something that was celebrated and exciting and promoting efficiency to something that was really bad for America as a whole. And I'm sure we'll talk more about that a bit later. But as this conversation began to take place, a lot of women's activists in the feminist movement or in the consumer or women's health movement made the argument, I think fairly persuasively, although the political establishment didn't really respond to it, that we need to understand the allure of tranquilizers in the 60s and 70s in the context of women's daily lives, that perhaps we need to be a little more empathetic to what it would be like to be a mother of five kids, having to have dinner ready for one's husband, having to deal with toddlers spit up and the oldest coming home with a new girlfriend all at the same time in the absence of universal daycare and proper social support. So a lot of feminists who are talking about what came to be seen as a problem with the feminization of tranquilizer use tried to make tranquilizers a kind of gateway for a larger political conversation about the place of women and the treatment of women in American society at this time.
Is there any way to distinguish those who were truly disabled by anxiety as opposed to those who might have coped without the medication but were sort of lured by the social phenomenon of Milltown and Valium and other drugs?
It's a really good question, and it's something that people who use the drugs, people who prescribe the drugs, people who are involved in the anxiety disorder movement debate ad nauseum. At what point does healthy anxiety become pathological anxiety? And I think it's very hard for one person, you or I, to say that someone else doesn't have an anxiety legitimate enough to deserve tranquilizers. And I sometimes use the case of a toddler, say, who has a horrible phobia about helium balloons. Now, you and I know, as do your listeners, that helium balloons aren't known for their homicidal attacks on toddlers and that a toddler is perfectly safe next to one. But for the toddler, the anxiety is absolutely real, and you can measure this physiologically. You can, you know, see their palms start to sweat, the tearing begins, their face turns red, they have heart palpitations. So even though we might say this is a really silly anxiety, for the person who's experiencing it, it's so subjective, but it's definitely real. So in this sense, you could say that anxiety is both biological in that the symptoms are sort of confirmed empirically, but also often linked to social and political constructs.
And just so that we don't lose sight of the fact, there is some anxiety that, as you mentioned, is healthy. There are evolutionary and physiological reasons why anxiety serves us when it is not inappropriate or outsized compared to the situation.
Absolutely. So it would be totally normal and desirable to be hiking, encounter a grizzly bear, and to feel immediately anxiety. And critics have made the case that if we just tranquilize everyone, if we lose sight of when healthy anxiety becomes truly pathological anxiety that requires tranquilizers, we're going to to remove our ability to judge in those situations. Or for, alas, a woman walking down a dark alley late at night, she encounters a silhouette of a man bearing a gun. It would be normal, healthy, and even a mechanism of self-preservation to feel anxious. If that person were totally drugged out and unable to discern the threat at hand, that would not be an ideal situation. But for most people taking tranquilizers, those aren't the kinds of scenarios that they find themselves in, and that's what makes the conversation about who should be taking them, are we overdiagnosed, underdiagnosed, so muddled sometimes.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Andrea Tone is my guest. Her book is called The Age of Anxiety, A History of America's Turbulent Affair with Tranquilizers. Let's speak to Ken in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Hi. I've got a comment leading to a question. The comment is, if you have two families, two men with families, one living in 1850s America, the other one living, say, in 1950s America, the one in the late 1850s, you know, if he doesn't provide for his family, they basically die for the winter. Not enough wood or for malnutrition. Well, in the 1950s America, maybe he lives in Manhattan as opposed to the guy in the 1850s lives on a farm. He's got social programs under him, but he's got a lot of stresses. He's got to provide for his family to make sure everybody's okay. I was wondering how your guest, physiologically, do those two stresses read the same to the body? I mean, the guy who really faces death for the winter and the guy who feels stress, but maybe a little less so. Thank you very much, and I hope that's clear enough for you.
Yeah, interesting question. Thanks, Ken.
It is an interesting question. I think, unfortunately, it's the one that's probably impossible to answer because the kinds of tools we use to measure anxiety and how we define it medically today didn't exist back in the 1850s. But I think the question really speaks to a larger point, and that is that anxiety, in terms of its symptomology, has existed since the beginning of time. And we can go back to look at, say, people who were involved in the Crusades, or we can look at men who were breadwinners in the Great Depression, or Ken's example of people who are facing imminent death in the 1850s, or people, you know, stressed out in the workplace in the 1950s. I mean, I think one could say that the kind of stress from work in the 1950s might very well be quite different from the fear of dying in war.
What sort of response was there from the general public when people started to recognize that they could actually get addicted to these drugs?
Well, one thing that's interesting about that story is that it takes so long for the general public to turn on tranquilizers. So as I mentioned earlier, medical studies began to be published in the late 1950s and early 1960s documenting the presence of a withdrawal reaction to taking people who'd been on tranquilizers and then suddenly switching them, say, to a placebo. And if people had really wanted to follow that, they could have, because the evidence for that was there. But manufacturers largely suppressed that from doctors, and so patients were experiencing these side effects largely on their own. So it takes really until the late 1960s and 1970s for the public to discover the larger dependency issue. And there's a huge moral panic in the late 1970s about the fact that so many Americans are taking drugs like Librium and Valium. And you know, it's useful to know that from the late 1960s to the early 1980s, Valium was actually the most widely prescribed pill, not only in the United States, but in the Western world. So there's a panic about this, and leading the panic is the link, as I mentioned earlier, between suburban housewives taking this, and you know, what does that mean for America if suburbia and apple pie is chemically contaminated? But also there's now several decades worth of evidence from patients that people can get addicted to these things. And when we say addiction, that itself is, you know, a loaded term. But we can break it down to a psychological dependence or needing to take a drug just to get through the day, and also a physiological dependence that becomes very clear when people try to stop taking the drug. So the memoir that becomes a New York Times bestseller that documents this in such a gripping way is Barbara Gordon's harrowing I'm Dancing as Fast as I Can. She was taking Valium in increasing doses for years and was told by her psychiatrist, if you want to stop taking the drug, stop taking it cold turkey. And she does, and she experiences the full horrors of what that meant. And it would be the case for pretty much anyone who had taken that amount of Valium for that period of time. But horrible insomnia. She described her scalp feeling like it was almost on fire, nausea, trembling, and people can actually, we know, die from a sudden cessation of benzodiazepines if they've taken them for a long enough period of time and at a high enough dosage. So there's a lot of concern suddenly about the fact that, you know, for decades we've been thinking of these drugs as peace pills or banal emotional aspirin, and these are now potent chemicals, and millions of people have taken them. So it becomes a much larger political issue.
How shocked was the nation to learn Betty Ford's story?
I think fairly shocked, but also wonderfully supportive. Betty Ford came out with her dual addiction to alcohol and Valium in 1978, so a year before Barbara Gordon's memoir was published. And she did it with her kind of legendary candor and grittiness. Listeners may recall that she'd also been very outspoken about her battle with breast cancer. And she had been known for saying things that ran against the Republican mainstream. And at one point, she was denounced as, instead of being the first lady, no lady at all. But when she talked about this and was finally institutionalized, she insisted on going not to a private rehabilitation center where she would get luxury treatment, which she certainly could have done, but much to her credit, she wanted to be treated the same way as any normal American would be treated, having to go through drug withdrawal. And she actually shared a room with many other women at an Army base rehabilitation center, and got thousands of letters from supporters across the country who congratulated her for being so public about what she had gone through, and just thanking her for letting others know that they were not alone in the journey that she herself was taking.
There's an interesting irony to the fact that now being treated at the Betty Ford Center is sort of a rite of passage for celebrities who are, instead of being on the drugs and very open about it, they're trying to get off drugs.
Yes, and I think that's one of the really interesting changes that we see in the history of tranquilizers between, say, the 1950s and today, is we're most likely to know that celebrities are taking tranquilizers after they've been institutionalized and it comes out on People magazine, or unfortunately, if people mix tranquilizers and alcohol and other drugs, and then the autopsy report is published. That's when we learn about it. It's very, very different from the days when Milton Berle was just, you know, saying on air, hey, I'm taking it, and you should be too. So it's become, in an interesting way, the medicalization of anxiety has almost worked to stigmatize the use of tranquilizers at the same time. So it's kind of veiled socially something that was once a quasi-public experience.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Ed in Fort Worth. Hi, Ed.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks.
I'm just wondering what your guest thinks about the idea that behind the problems with drugs, I know that 90% of psychiatric-type medications, such as the ones that we're talking about, are prescribed by non-psychiatric physicians who are probably well-trained in their area, but perhaps not as well-trained in the area of psychiatric medications. Also, the pressure today for what they call the primary care physician to practice outside of his area of expertise because of the financial pressure from the managed care companies, so that patients don't get sent to psychiatrists to be assessed, evaluated, and treated. also the idea that what's happened is we've gotten so far away from the idea of psychotherapy. Not that psychotherapy is going to treat everything, but it certainly is a tool that perhaps could keep people from being so addicted to medications if they learned how to develop the skills to deal with these problems themselves with their inner strength.
Thanks very much for your call.
Sure, thank you.
I think that's a really good series of points. I think one of the things that Milltown changed is it mainstreamed psychiatry by transferring the care of psychiatric patients from the therapist's couch and putting that power into the everyday practitioner's script pad. And studies that were done on who was prescribing tranquilizers showed that as early as 1960, three-quarters of all doctors in the United States admitted to having prescribed them, and the vast majority of those doing the prescribing were not psychiatrists. And it was psychiatrists early on who were really very concerned that these drugs were being used pretty permissively, and many of them urged that patients be told about the side effects, that they think twice about just taking drugs for problems that might better be treated by psychotherapy. And, of course, psychotherapy, as your guest mentions, has itself changed over time. So back in the 1950s, when Milltown was released, the dominant model was Freudian psychoanalysis. Today, there are a lot of psychotherapeutic treatments for anxiety disorders, which have proven to be very, very successful. So cognitive behavioral therapy works wonders on phobias, and indeed, perhaps that is an approach that politically we should be supportive of.
We'll return in just a minute to our discussion with Andrea Tone. Her new book is called The Age of Anxiety, A History of America's Turbulent Affair with Tranquilizers. If you want to join us, you can get on the phone line at 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses beginning in January. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Canada Research Chair in the Social History of Medicine at McGill University, Andrea Tone. Her book is called The Age of Anxiety, A History of America's Turbulent Affair with Tranquilizers. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Andrea, to what extent did the existence of tranquilizers create the definition of anxiety?
That's a great question. I think that to a large extent, the response to tranquilizers changes what it meant to be anxious. Back in the 1950s, there wasn't really a medical consensus about what anxiety was. Over time, Americans' really enthusiastic response to tranquilizers encouraged research on the biological basis of anxiety. In the 1970s, scientists in Denmark and also in the United States discovered what are called benzodiazepine receptors, which explained how anxiety worked. So by the 1970s and 1980s, it's the kind of ground, grassroots interest in tranquilizers that gets corporations, scientists, government agencies much more interested in anxiety as a medical and biological condition. But I don't think it would have happened if people hadn't, you know, immediately embraced tranquilizers as a kind of emotional aspirin.
How different chemically are today's anti-anxiety medications, things like Xanax and Paxil?
Well, Xanax is a benzodiazepine, whereas Paxil is an antidepressant. And one of the things that happens as a result of the backlash against tranquilizers that is very pronounced in the United States and in the UK in the 1970s and 1980s is that government agencies and the Justice Department try to rein in what is perceived as the overuse of tranquilizers. And manufacturers of SSRIs, such as Paxil and Zoloft, Prozac, try to take advantage of this commercial vacuum that occurs as benzodiazepines are stigmatized and frowned upon to really push drugs such as Paxil as a better anti-anxiety medication. And a lot of money is poured into some of the campaigns to make Paxil the drug of choice for anxious Americans. And it works to some extent in the sense that for many people, SSRIs can treat anxiety disorders very effectively. And by anxiety disorders, I mean things like panic disorder or post-traumatic stress disorder, social anxiety, or it's sometimes called social phobia. But what's equally interesting is that there's a gap between the public condemnation of tranquilizers and the recurring use of tranquilizers. So even though they're frowned upon because of their addictive potential, in fact, for many patients, patients and doctors alike realize tranquilizers such as Xanax simply work better. And the one thing that could never be said against tranquilizers is that they don't work pretty effectively on someone who hasn't had them before. So if you have someone who has a fear of flying and they're about to board a plane, you could give them, say, Paxil, and nothing's going to happen because it takes some time for Paxil to create that anxiolytic benefit. Or you could give them Valium or Xanax, and it's going to work very quickly. And that's always been one of the sort of exciting things medically or pharmacologically about tranquilizers, is that they are robustly effective.
Do you imagine that, today's very popular antidepressants will have the sort of future that, we've seen with tranquilizers? Will they come to a point where they're frowned upon to a much greater extent than they are today?
I think they're already becoming frowned upon. I mean, I think that tide has started to turn.
Prozac Nation and things like that?
Yes, I think that people have successfully documented a withdrawal reaction from SSRIs that we have also documented with tranquilizers. And it's not at all clear whether, and here I'm going to speak as a historian rather than an MD because I don't have prescribing potential, and I think that's probably a good thing. But, you know, we have seen plenty of studies showing that you can't simply stop taking Effexor or Zoloft. You're going to go through, for many people, horrible withdrawal reactions. And for anxiety disorders, it's not really clear whether SSRIs are better at treating those disorders than some of the old-time tranquilizers, the benzodiazepines.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next to Jim in Arlington. Hey, Jim.
Hey, this is Jim.
Hi.
Yeah, I have a couple questions. What would your definition be of what an appropriate use of minor tranquilizers would be? And have there been any studies about how tranquilizer use might affect longevity? Because, you know, like stress and anxiety are a contributor to aging prematurely, you know, and people might possibly live longer if they use them appropriately or not.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any information on that?
Yep. I would say that appropriate use is a definition that has to be sorted out between an individual and his or her physician, and that one of the problems that we face in the United States is that we live in the age of sort of a one-size-fits-all approach to medicine and pill popping, and that one person's level or definition of appropriate use, at what point it becomes necessary to take tranquilizers, is going to vary considerably from another person's. We also know that people respond very differently to the same drug. So in a perfect world, we would all be getting the kind of medical care and attention that one of the other callers had suggested might be in order, where we might have recourse to psychiatrists or therapists who could help us determine whether pharmacological intervention is even necessary. But I really shy away from making, I think, the kinds of sweeping generalizations that are often made about psychiatric drugs. I think it's really important to treat individuals as sort of chemically unique and to realize that everyone is going to have a different threshold that will determine at what point tranquilizers really are merited, and it's not for me to decide what that threshold is.
And the question about longevity doesn't really come up in the book. I don't know if that's something you've had the opportunity to study or to sort of see research on.
Yeah, it comes up in the context that pharmaceutical companies are certainly very eager to make that connection, saying that stress is hazardous to your health, that it can cause high blood pressure, that it can perhaps encourage coronary heart disease, and therefore taking tranquilizers may increase longevity. But that's something that has been subsequently debated, and some people have discredited it. So I don't know that I would make a firm statement about the science behind that.
Does tranquilizer use tend to rise in times of recession?
Yes, and also during times of political crisis. So what's interesting is that throughout our love affair with tranquilizers, which I would say, you know, starts in the 1950s, sales of tranquilizers have skyrocketed during the Christmas period and New Year's, which is sort of sad in a way. But we all have sort of fantasies of family togetherness and cozy snuggle time, perhaps not in Texas, but certainly here in Montreal around the fire. And the reality is often, you know, parents struggling at 2 a.m. to assemble the bike that they're told requires no assembly. They're, you know, rushing to make the perfect holiday menu. People go back to work after the New Year's, and they're heavier on the scale, and they're dealing with greater debts. And, you know, companies are savvy, and they recognize that this is their great sales period. And so even as early as the late 1950s, the manufacturer of Milltown, Carter Wallace, sent out a record to doctors across the country, which they were encouraged to play to patients in their waiting rooms, which on the one side played the 12 Days of Christmas, and on the other side was an infomercial for a new combination drug that was half tranquilizer, half appetite suppressant, and the theme was that you no longer had to be stressed about having to control your appetite and slim down in the new year. But yes, there is a very strong correlation between times of economic hardship, emotional hardship, political anxiety, such as what happened after 9/11, and rising tranquilizer use.
You actually had a period in your life where you used tranquilizers on a limited basis. I wonder if you can describe the impact it had on you and sort of how they worked for you personally.
Yes, and I was sort of hesitant to include that because I think if you out yourself as someone who's tried them, then it sort of colors the politics of what you write about. But when I had wrapped up my last book, which is on the history of contraceptive technology, I had occasion to fly to New York City to participate in a PBS film that was based on one of the chapters. And as I was flying, and I had always loved flying to the point where when I was taking helicopter rides in California, I was the one in the family who was going, yippee, turbulence, hooray, as my mother turned greener and greener. But we hit a patch of turbulence. This was back in 2001, and it completely unnerved me. And it was really unexpected because I'd flown so many times before. And I thought, well, it must be because I'm nervous being filmed for the first time. But I had the same experience when I hit turbulence on the way back to Atlanta, which is where I lived at the time. And so I saw my doctor, and I was very resistant to the idea of the quick fix. And what I really wanted, in fact, looking back, was what one of your callers, you know, referred to as, you know, therapy to help one through this. And as I mentioned earlier, there's a really good track record for helping people with things like fear of flying among cognitive behavioral therapists. But the problem for me was that I had just had a baby. I didn't have maternity leave at the university I was at. My health care didn't cover the kind of comprehensive counseling that I probably would have needed to help me get through that phobia. So we sort of shook our heads and said, well, what can be done? And my doctor said, you know, I know you're going to feel stigmatized by this, but I really think you should try taking a tranquilizer about 30 minutes before you fly again. And my response was, well, I'm not going to take a tranquilizer. I mean, come on, that's for a different kind of person. I'm not that person. And she said, if it gets you on the plane and if it encourages you to disassociate turbulence with anxiety, then it will achieve a kind of rudimentary form of exposure therapy. And so, in fact, it worked. What I would do is I would take, the drug was Ativan. I would take it only before I boarded a flight. And after about 6 or 10 flights, feeling calm, even when there was turbulence, just kind of reinforced something I knew rationally and scientifically, which is that turbulence does not mean you're about to plunge to a fiery death. Turbulence just means you've hit, you know, a little bit of air weirdness in the skies, and it's nothing to panic about. So in that particular case, the drug helped me sort of get to a point in my life where I could fly without fear.
Did that experience allow you to relate to the people who got addicted to tranquilizers and used them on a regular basis, or is that still hard for you to comprehend?
No, I think having interviewed so many patients who took them, I think my every experience is unique. And for me, taking tranquilizers to fly was perhaps different for someone who's taking tranquilizers just to get through the day. And that's not something I've had to do, fortunately. But I do think I feel tremendous empathy for, you know, housewives in the 60s or President Kennedy, who took tranquilizers. And people who took them perhaps not knowing what the side effects were, perhaps not having the kinds of choices to be treated differently. I think we live in a society where pharmaceutical pragmatism is often the answer because we don't have other options that are really available to us. And I'm really sort of loathe to condemn those who get locked into drug taking if they're really in a situation economically or socially where there aren't other options.
So are we better off as a society when we understand anxiety more as a pathology as opposed to an inevitable fact of life?
Well, I think the two coexist. I think it can be a pathology for some people, and I think in other cases it's just an inevitable fact of life. And part of the great question is determining on a case-by-case basis what the difference is between them.
Andrea Tone is Canada Research Chair in the Social History of Medicine at McGill University. Her new book is called The Age of Anxiety, A History of America's Turbulent Affair with Tranquilizers. Andrea, really fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks so much for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.